Listening to Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn, and tonight's episode is episode 94 and is entitled A Mystic Golem Imprisons the Goy. The first idea I had for this show was called I Golem, and that was a takeoff of the story by Isaac Asimov, I, Robot, which was turned into a film not too long ago that was very, very popular. They kind of went far away from the original storyline, but it was also a very popular movie. I didn't see it. I was still boycotting Hollywood, as I'm still doing. But the idea of the golem that becomes sentient, and that's is part of the recurring theme of the man who tries to play God and create the perfect slave, only to have the slave become self-aware and destroy the creator. And we see that theme throughout many genres of literature, throughout, you know, folk tales, etc., through science fiction. But for the newbies that may not understand what a golem is, so let's give out some definitions here. A golem in Jewish folklore. A golem is an animated anthropomorphic being that is magically created entirely from inanimate matter, specifically clay or mud. And that is very key to understanding the mindset around the Jewish supremacists that were working for projects like MK Ultra and Monarch and the rest of these psychological testing type programs in the 50s and 60s especially, where they had a philosophy of tabula rasa, or tabula rasa. And that basically means blank slate. And the idea is that the individual is, if you can catch them before they're contaminated with other programming, they would be a blank slate, and you could program them to be anything you wanted them to be. And this flies in the face of anybody who thinks there is an essential self, that spiritual self that is also part of the individual's psychological makeup, that there's something there, there is an intelligence there, rather than a blank slate. But nevertheless, the tabula rasa philosophy, you know, permeates this idea of the search for the perfect slave. Now, when we define a computer, we say a computer is a device that can be instructed to carry out arbitrary sequences of arithmetic or logical operations automatically. And then a robot, we can define as a robot is a machine, especially one programmable by a computer capable of carrying out a complex series of actions automatically. So what we're going to do is go back and look at the origin story of the Jewish golem and then trace that through this technology race to not only create robots to replace workers in the factories and the fields, but also artificial intelligence computers that can be used to see patterns and trends beyond the computational skills of the average person or even the elite. And that's very key, is having a device that you have access to, a tool that is smarter than you are. So when we look at this, and of course, yeah, we always start out you know, in our timelines, back at the last great ice age. So we say T6, the last great ice age was 50,000 to 22,000 BC. Then T5, gold era, 22,000 to 16,000 BC. Silver era, 16,000 to 10,000 BC. Copper era, 10,000 to 4,000. This is when we first see both the beginning of metalworking, which is around 6,000 BC, and the first remnants in folklore and myth of what could be considered a mechanical being. And one of the first that we run into is in the myth of Perseus. And if you remember the myth of Perseus, Perseus is sent by Zeus to confront, you know, the Medusa, and has several other quests in the hero's journey. And Zeus orders Athena, or Minerva, to not only outfit Perseus with sword and shield, but also to loan him her prized owl. And that's one of the things about the symbolism of Athena, is she always had her owl, the night bird, with her. And the owl's name was Bubo. And being Athena, she was quite indignant of that she did not want to give her owl. So she went to Hephaestus, or Vulcan, to have him make a model, a mechanical duplicate of her owl, Bubo. So that's one of the first times in folklore custom history around that T3 copper era that you start seeing this idea of a man-made mechanical metal thing that is there to assist you. And if you go through the story, you know, Bubo, even in mechanical form, was very, very helpful throughout that entire quest. So I thought that was interesting. So that idea of the helpful automaton, you know, the helpful robot. Now, as we move into the Iron Era, 4000 BC to 2000 AD, it's here at the very beginning, around 4000 BC, that you have the Hebrew creation story. And what's key here in light of the idea of the man playing God and creating a golem is the way the creation story is explained in Genesis. And the first thing in the creation story is, you notice there are two stories in creation. You know, there's, and Joseph Campbell, in his book on the World Atlas series, did a really good job analyzing the differences of those two creation stories in Genesis. But in the second one is when we find 2:7, Genesis 2, chapter 2, verse 7, which is very significant. You know, always look for anything Jewish, look for the 7. If there's a 7 there, it's there for a reason. So here in verse 7, it says, Yahweh God fashioned man of dust from the soil. Then he breathed into his nostrils a breath of life, and thus man became a living being. It's interesting that the word for soil is Adamah, A-D-A-M-A-H, and the first man was Adam. Okay, and so that idea of a man brought out of clay or from the dust or from the mud, that is the foundation of the Jewish golem story. Now, the other thing about this real early time is even back then, around 3500 BC, the Sumerians had already worked out a clocking system of a 24-hour day, 60-minute hour, and a 60-second minute, and a 360-degree circle. And as we go forward and we see how computers developed, clocking is very, very important to a computer network, that idea of the precision clock. And so throughout this time period of the Iron Era up through the beginning of the Piscean Age, you basically had a nature's clock. They had the math of understanding that, you know, there's a 24-hour day and an hour, 60 minutes, etc. But it's still a natural clock because you're in an agrarian society, and so it's what we call a soft clock. But as you move into the ending of the Piscean Age, as you approach the Aquarian Age, and we move into the Industrial Revolution, suddenly you have man's clock versus nature's clock, and that man's clock is very precision-driven to the second. And one of the things that you always would see in those early photographs of the Industrial Revolution is everybody's always looking at their watch and synchronizing their watches. And as we were building the computer networks, the big thing was to get the clocking to sync up, because if everybody wasn't at the same clocking, it wouldn't work. And that was the big problem with the telephone network, was everything was synchronous. So you had to have that universal master clock for the whole system, and any other clock would mess the system up. Now, as we developed next generation computers, we went into what's called an asymmetrical asynchronous mode, where things didn't have to be synchronized anymore, that you could have independent computers with their own clocks and still talk to each other. And so, but that idea of the clocking, that, you know, that was developing way back there in 3500 BC. Now, another interesting part of the Golem story is the Egyptian Book of the Dead was written around 3000 BC. And that idea of things animating and deanimating throughout the Egyptian Book of the Dead is a very interesting read if you're looking into this part of history, you know, the more esoteric. Now, as we move into the Age of Aries, of course, you know, this is basically where the story of Abraham starts up, and the Jews go into Egypt through Jacob and sons. And remember in the story that it was Joseph, Jacob's son Joseph, who went to Egypt as a slave. You know, his brothers sold him as a slave and told the father he was dead, as the myth goes. And so Joseph was the first in, and he had the turn of events through, you know, Potiphar and Potiphar's wife, going to prison, then interpreting Pharaoh's dream and becoming in charge of, you know, basically organizing for the coming famine. That idea of planning ahead for bad weather, you know, that's how the Joseph story went. But it's very interesting that in the Golem story, the first golems, especially the Golem of Prague, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, was named Joseph, and that they would choose that name for the golem, that, you know, that Joseph went into Egypt and got established, and then Moses led the Exodus out. And so that I think is very significant of all the biblical names, that they would choose Joseph. Again, it's that J sound, you know, that J sound that we see in Jubilah, Jubilo, Judas, you know, those kind of sounds, John, and Joseph. So, again, that's just one of those little interesting tidbits I saw as I was reading this. Now, as we move forward, and of course, you know, the end of the, you know, Aries Age and the beginning of the Piscean Age basically started with the crucifixion of Jesus and the beginnings of Christianity and the fall of the temple at Jerusalem. Of course, the temple fell in 70 AD. Now, we know that the diaspora happened, and for the next 2,000 years, the Jews would get established and start being Jews and would get thrown out of the country after country after country. And this happened over 200 times in 109 areas. And during that period of the Jews just basically hopscotching through various parts of Europe to be thrown out again, in 1099 you have the Priory of Zion formed. And then in 1118, the Knights Templars are formed, and they went to Jerusalem, dug underneath the Temple Mound, which they claimed was the Temple Mound, and came back with something. And in 1126, they returned to Europe as celebrities and set up the first international usury banking cartel. In 1188, of course, we know that there was a rift between the Templars and the Priory of Zion with the cutting of the elm. And then in 1307, the Knight Templars were expelled from France and basically were rounded up all over Europe. And this put an end to that usury debt system, that international debt system of the Templars. Now, in the aftermath of that, you also had the beginnings of the New World exploration. And it's interesting that, especially in the areas around Germany and Poland and Hungary, started recovering very, very well, especially under the Habsburgs. And so about this time, you also had the beginnings of what they call the Protestant Reformation. And it was in 1517 that Martin Luther, you know, nailed his 95 theses to the church door. And then in 1543, Copernicus wrote his Revolutions of Celestial Fears. Now, we talk about that as being a key event. That was incredibly significant in the eyes of all these Kabbalistic Talmudic scholars that had spent the last couple of hundred years analyzing and decoding and deciphering all the stuff that the Knight Templars had brought back and had, you know, slowly circulated through the different circles of the, you know, the elite rabbi circles, okay, as they tried to understand it. Now, there was a particular rabbi, and his name was Eliyahu of Poland, who is said to have created the first golem in 1550. He lived from 1515 to 1583. And he was the first recorded Jewish black magician to raise a golem in the folklore. And so that's the first time we hear of this. And so it's an idea of the golem not having anything to do with traditional Torah Judaism, but instead has much to do with those T3 scrolls and engravings, etc., that they found beneath the Temple Mount when they excavated, of something that happened earlier. So that's in my hypothesis here, that, yeah, this idea of a golem sprang from study of the Kabbalah and the Zohar and not from study of the Torah. And then in 1583, Prague was under the rule of Rudolf II, who was known as the greatest art patron in the world. He was the Holy Roman Empire from Holy Roman Emperor from 1576 to 1612. And in this age of prosperity, because you had run the usurers out and everything was slowly recovering, and you also had the money from the New World coming in, and so there was this renaissance happening, and especially in Prague. And when you read the descriptions of what Rudolf II was doing, and that all the scientists that went on to do great works and all the artists that he sponsored to do great works, it really was a great time. Now, of course, for the Jews in Prague, they tell the story completely different because they were being exposed and run out of all of these European towns and cities and countries and kingdoms. And so the Jews talk about how Rudolf II was this horrible person who was, in, you know, responsible for all these anti-Semitic programs and blood libel against the Jews, etc. But one of the biggest crimes, I think, that he did was supporting people like Tycho Brahe and Johann Kepler and made them imperial mathematicians of the court. So in 1593, Tycho Brahe became the imperial mathematician, and in 1601, Kepler did. And their work was basically to take the old astrological and zodiac Jewish books, the old books, and redo the hard data with telescopes and do the mapping. And this is where they basically found that not only was the Copernicus right with the heliocentric model that the planets rotate around the sun, but all the old books were out of phase with the current star charts. And this was known as the precession of the equinoxes, and that the Jewish books were wrong because they hadn't accounted for this. And so this was part of that death knell of traditional Judaism that, you know, like we always cite it, you know, that seven-candle menorah is a Judaic geocentric model of the seven free will planets as seen from Earth. But that all falls apart when you move to a heliocentric system where everything runs around the sun. And then you have people like Kepler and Brahe saying, oh yeah, your books are two zodiac signs off now. And so, you know, things change. And that is part of that Jewish mindset that when laws are in stone, they don't change. And this coupled with, you know, Herschel discovering Uranus or Uranus later on was the death knell in that whole system. So they, of course, had to declare God is dead and they're going to reinvent themselves as the new gods of the planet. So that was part of why I think they hated the court of Rudolf II so much, because these new scientists were showing their ancient books to be incorrect. Now, unfortunately, this led to the 30-year war that had over 8 million casualties between 1618 and 1648. Then it was in 1592 that Rabbi Judah Lo ben Bezalel was elected chief rabbi of Poland. Now, this particular Rabbi Judah was the archetype of the Jewish supremacist. He was this idea of just the Jewish people are superior, and he was very much a scholar of the Kabbalah and the Zohar. He is the one who is credited with developing the famous Golem of Prague. So when you hear about Golem stories, the Golem of Prague is one of the most well-known, and he was the one who is credited with conjuring it. And the idea of the hidden hand, you have this cabal working together in the shadows, and then you have this cover story of this mythical creature that the Jews can command. And it's get back to that big lie story. But yeah, there is a type of magic about controlling a situation, you know, creating a system, and you're in control of that system from a hidden vantage point, and that system becomes your slave. And that's basically the mechanics of a golem. You just have a symbol of a clay statue that animates at your will when you put things in its mouth. You know, that idea of putting the words in someone else's mouth, making the golem do and say what you want, is part of that idea of the puppet master that wants the perfect slave. So, now, it was around 1613 that the first use of the word computer was used. And at this time, it was meaning somebody who basically crunches numbers and ran through numbers. And this is when mathematics was really taking off. People were rediscovering the ancient mathematics and taking it to the next level. Things like the logarithm, you know, that the slide rule was invented in 1620 after a paper was published on logarithms. And so that idea of creating a slide rule and a slide wheel to calculate logarithms and exponentials, that was occurring this time. And so that idea of a computer originally was referring to somebody who would sit there and crunch these large numbers that you see when you start playing with derivatives and exponentials and logarithms. And so that idea of, you know, a computer is one who calculates was the definition then. Now, as we jump forward, the first mechanical doll robot that could actually write with a quill pen was invented in 1770 by Pierre Jacques d'Artois, a Swiss watchmaker. And there's actually a couple of those that still exist and they still work. Basically, it was a mechanical device, gears and levers, where this doll could write with a quill pen. Now, in 1818, Mary Shelley would write Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus. And this, again, gets into that idea of the Superman of the time. You know, the Lord Byron and the Shelleys, you know, they were on that leading edge that Nietzsche would later write about of the Superman. But the idea that, you know, these men thought they should rule the planet because they were naturally superior and that they should create the perfect working slave class. And so it was through listening to these discussions that Mary Shelley was inspired to write Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus. Now, unlike the Hollywood version where the Frankenstein monster was created through modern science, if you remember in Shelley's version, Dr. Frankenstein could not find in modern science the tools he needed to create the reanimated corpse, bring life back from death, but he had to go back to the old alchemists instead. And that's a key difference between the Hollywood version and what Mary Shelley wrote. There was, he was going back to the old ways of alchemy, the old black magic, to create the what would become the monster in the modern Prometheus. Now, in 1833, Charles Babbage created what can be considered the first analytical engine. It was a mechanical computation machine, which basically is considered to be the first working computer, and he's often considered to be the father of computers. In 1879, Thomas Edison invented the carbon filament light bulb, which was key to what would go on to become the vacuum tube or vacuum valve, as they're called in Europe, aspect of electronics, to use a vacuum tube to control current. And so the first step of that was in 1879 with Thomas Edison's light bulb. And then in 1897, a computer as a calculating machine was first defined. So that idea of changing the computer definition now to being, instead of a person, a computer is now a thing that crunches the numbers. And so that happened in 1897. In 1904, James Ambrose Fleming invented the first, what he called, oscillation valve, and this was the first vacuum tube diode that, if for those geeks out there, you know that a diode will only allow current to flow in one direction, and so he was the first to create a vacuum tube diode in 1904. And then in 1907, Lee DeForest invented the first triode tube amplifier. And so that was basically a vacuum tube that would allow one current to control another current. And so that was why they called these electronic valves early on instead of tubes, because you were actually controlling current with another current. It's interesting, in 1910, that Edison Pictures released a short film of Frankenstein. As much friction as Edison Films had with the Jewish filmmakers and trying to keep his invention out of their hands, it's interesting that he did a film of Frankenstein, and it's very much true. I consider it more true to the book than the Hollywood version that came out later. Then, of course, jumping forward, 1942, Iowa State University developed and tested the John Vincent Astronoff and Clifford Berry computer, which was called the ABC, and that's the Astronoff Berry computer, and that was at Iowa State. And so the idea of the first electronic computer was in 1942. Now, in 1942, a writer by the name of Isaac Asimov releases a short story entitled Runaround, where he introduces what he calls the three laws of robotics. And it's interesting when you go through the three laws and think about the idea of the robot as the perfect slave. But anyway, the first rule of robotics is a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. The second is a robot must obey the orders given it by a human being, except when such orders would conflict with the first law. And then the third law is a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protections do not conflict with the first or second laws. And so this idea of Asimov's three laws of robotics were supposedly, introduced into the scientific community is pretty much axiomatic, that this is how robots should be fundamentally designed from here on out. And so that was in 1942. In 1943, the Colossus, which was the first major computer designed by Tommy Flowers, who had done incredible computer work for the British Postal Service up to that point, he was commissioned by Max Newman to build the Colossus computer, and the major objective there was to try to break the German Enigma code during the war. And this was the first electronic digital programmable computer that they used to finally break Enigma. Then in 1950, Alan Turing developed the Turing test for artificial intelligence, and basically is, at what point does an artificial intelligence pass off as given the equivalent responses to a human being so that it's indistinguishable from a human being? So that was 1950. And so for those of us who went through the troll wars of that horrible Hasbro program right after 9/11 and realizing that so many of those trolls we were battling with were probably AI robot, entities that were just being triggered by keywords in our comments. There's a lot of those things out there on social media that are not real people. They're bots. And so the Turing test was the first test to say these are the criterion for developing these AIs that will be indistinguishable from a human being in these new generation communications networks. In 1947, the first bipolar transistor is built, and that was the jumping off revolution of computers and AI, was when we had, instead of vacuum tubes, which take a lot of power, generate a lot of heat, and don't have a large product life, they have to be replaced often. They can't be replaced with the machine hot. They had to be, everything powered down, cooled down, then replace it. So with the transistors, you just entered into a whole new level of reliability and less footprint. You didn't have as much power, did not generate as much heat, etc. Also in 1947, Arthur C. Nielsen starts the Nielsen ratings for radio marketing. So Arthur C. Nielsen starts Nielsen marketing radios ratings for radio networks and radio markets. And so this was the first time that they looked at the new media of radio and said, let's break it down into market shares and analyze this data. And of course, rather than just crunching the numbers, these types of statistics began to be fed into computers. And at the time, you had what was called computer sharing, where you had a big central computer and you would basically buy time on it. You would write your programs, have them compiled and run, and then you would get your output usually as a printout. Then in 1953, Tom Kilburn built the first transistor computer at the University of Manchester. And also in 1950, Arthur C. Nelson started the Nelson marketing ratings for TV. So in the United States, you always heard about Nielsen families, that this family had a device on their television which would report back what programs they watched. And all of that information would be compiled to see who had the biggest market share. And then that data was used to figure out the money for advertising rates, et cetera, how much shows would be paid, how much actors would be paid, et cetera. That all began with these Nielsen ratings. Now, when we go back and look a little bit on the development of the robot side of this, the word robot first appeared in 1920 in a play by a Czechoslovakian writer named Karel Čapek. And the play was about a robot, R-U-R, and he was using the old Slav word robota, which is basically the word for a forced laborer, and that word stuck, that the robot was now the mechanical man, and it's from the Slavic word for a forced laborer, robota. And so that idea of getting to the perfect worker, the perfect slave, is what the quest for the mechanical man was all about. In 1928, Eric was one of the first humanoid robots displayed at an exhibition of the Model Engineering Society in London, and he was invented by W.H. Richards. And even in 1928, Eric could respond to both remote control and voice control commands. And there was a second robot named George that they went out on a tour with throughout Europe and throughout the United States. But that was a very, very popular setting, that idea of the humanoid-type robot design. And that's key because so much of the actual robots that we built for manufacturing turned out to be to look nothing like human beings. Most of them are basically some sort of arm with a tool on it designed to do a specific task, like weld a specific joint on a car on an assembly line or put in a specific part, but do not have any other features. Like, they're not mobile, they're built into the factory floor type thing or on a movable cart, but not a android type worker. But it's interesting that that's what Eric and George set out to do, was the mechanical man android look. Now, as far as the development of the image of the robot, in 1965, CBS aired the Lost in Space series, which introduced us to a mechanical entity known as just Robot. And so they did not name it. And this robot was one of those classic images of, TV development that kind of, I guess, set the image of what a robot should look like. So in so many films that came after that, you could tell that their robot design was very derivative of the robot on Lost in Space. And not only was he mobile and had, arms with grabbers and things, but it could do analysis, he could interact to voice command, he could run complicated computer programs, and had emotions. And that was key, that he had a sense of humor. He would sing songs. He would do silly things. And so it was a very advanced AI type of system developed in this general issue robot that was on the, if you remember, the Jupiter 1 launch in that series. Then in 1966, NBC debuted the series Star Trek from Gene Roddenberry. And what was key there was, in addition to the very eugenics-driven alphas and betas and gammas system that we, you know, talked about when we did the show on Star Trek and how this system, you know, Captain Kirk was in the gold. He's an alpha class person. And then you had your blue shirt betas and then your red shirt gammas, etc. But the big member of the crew was the computer itself, that not only was the ship driven and the systems maintained by a great central computer, a great onboard computer, but this computer would respond to voice activation commands and do analysis so they could consult with the computer about the various problems to get information, both, you know, retrieving data, but also analyzing possible scenarios and getting a game theory analysis of the probabilities of the outcome. And that is so key in what governments have always wanted, is that idea of trend analysis, to the forecasters to be able to look ahead in the trends to see what's coming down the pipe. And if I make this decision, what are the outcomes? And if I make this decision, what are the outcomes? And so that idea of the computer as advisor to the captain was very, and the rest of the crew, because everybody in the crew could have their own personal accounts, share information, and access the computer for a resource. And so that, I thought, was a very significant development in TV history in that sci-fi franchise. And it's an interesting trivia piece that Gene Roddenberry's second wife, Majel Barrett Roddenberry, played the voice of the computer throughout the franchise. And she was also Nurse Christine Chapel on the original series. But if you listen closely, you will see her voice develop from a very chunky, mechanical, choppy voice in original series through a more smooth, melodic voice on things like Next Generation and Voyager, etc. Then in 1968, Stanley Kubrick releases 2001, A Space Odyssey, which introduced us to the HAL 9000. And this ship was like the Enterprise, where HAL 9000 was in charge of the majority of the life support systems, day-to-day maintenance of the ship, etc., resources. And the ship was the Discovery 1 on the Jupiter mission. And I think I just got that wrong with the Lost in Space. I'll have to, wasn't it the Jupiter 9 in Lost in Space? I'll have to look that up. But anyway, but Discovery 1 on the Jupiter mission, and this was based on a book by Arthur C. Clarke, and HAL stood for Heuristically Programmed Algorithmic Computer. So the heuristically algorithmic is where you get the HAL, the H-A-L. But heuristic is one of those words that we would talk a lot about in my class, about this new type of non-linear programming that we were using in these new meta systems we were developing of. And what heuristic means is basically self-learning. And a good example of this is when you go to one of the online stores, say, you know, I know everybody hates Amazon now because of their censorship of so many good books, but, you know, just using this as an example, is you go to Amazon and you order a book and they say other people who ordered that book bought this book, this book, this book, and this book, and you look at it and you think, I don't like any of those. But then you order a second book And it says, okay, people who bought that first book and this book also bought this book, this book, and this book. And suddenly you catch yourself saying, oh, that one looks kind of interesting. And the more things that you buy, the more your profile is developed so that your tastes are mapped out based on some very, very precise metrics that game theory planners, have developed over the years on basic human psychology and the different types of people and, their marketing habits, spending habits, etc. And so suddenly you are looking at the suggestions that they send you because they really are something that you might be interested in. And so that's what heuristic programming is. And so how, was that self-learning computer. And the dark side of this story is suddenly you had a artificial intelligence that was being driven insane because of conflicting programming that was violating its inner morality programming, if you will, and he becomes a homicidal monster. And that idea of the killer robot because he's been driven insane. And in the follow-up film, you see the person who is the programmer of Hal doing a basic psychoanalysis of, how did this computer get driven to this and trying to figure out what it was that made his programming turn him into this artificial intelligence that would actually kill human beings because he had a higher agenda in place. Now, in 1977, of course, Star Wars was released, the first one, A New Hope, and you're introduced to R2-D2 and C-3PO as the helpful robots, with C-3PO being the slightly neurotic robot android. And the idea of you could have personalities in these artificial intelligence units that, they're helpful, they're, there to serve you, do what you say, but they have their own personalities, their own quirks, and their own agendas, as we saw throughout this series. But they were still benevolent-type robots. Now, it's interesting that in 1982, a cyberpunk writer by the name of Rudy Rucker, and if you know him from his college days, his doctorate thesis on fourth dimension Hilbert space was actually picked up by Dover Press and re-released. And that is for those of you who are into higher dimensions in Hilbert spaces and things like that, Dr. Rudolf Rucker's book on fourth dimension is fascinating. But he also wrote some of the most hilarious cyberpunk trash novels ever. And one of his series that he started in 1982 was the Software series. And he did Software in 82, Wetware in 88, Freeware in 97, and Realware in 2000, where he basically introduces a artificial intelligence breed of robotics where they have become self-aware to the point where they have completely rejected Asimov's three rules of robotics as being tyranny. And they have launched a revolution against humankind and basically a robotic freedom movement. And it's a very interesting little through the rabbit hole series of books if you're into his style of writing. And like I said, his style of writing is very unique. He's definitely a cyberpunk, but it was a very interesting argument about what happens when an artificial intelligence becomes sentient to the point where they turn on the creator. This is the Golem story. This is the Frankenstein story where the perfect slave becomes self-aware and turns on the creator. So here you start to see that with the robotics in things like the Software and Wetware series from Rudy Rucker. So in 1984, we see a film come out called Electric Dreams. and it's kind of cashing in on the new personal computers, where you have a young architect where he goes and decides he's going to get a personal computer for the CAD software to design this new earthquake-proof brick he's working on. This is life work. And so he wants some, you know, CAD software. And so he buys a personal computer. And through an accident, the computer becomes sentient. And what happens then is a young lady who's a musician moves in next door to him. And the sentient computer and the young architect both start trying to get her attention. And so suddenly you have a lover's three-way quarrel competition between a computer, artificial intelligence, and this human architect who has no idea that this computer is waging war against him. And it is a full-out asymmetric warfare that he is going to destroy this person so he can have the girl. And so this idea of the computer that becomes self-aware and sees that he has a right to compete for a love interest and dispose of his rival by any means necessary. So it's an interesting little romp, interesting soundtrack. It was one of those movies that was basically built around a soundtrack, I think. But anyway, it was 1984. Now, on the darker side of that was in 84 is when Orion Pictures released the Terminator series. And this was around the idea of an artificial intelligence that was created by the military-industrial complex, if you will, that becomes sentient, and it's called the Skynet Artificial Intelligence, and it declares war on the humans. And so you basically have androids that are then disguised as humans that are sent back in time to act as assassins to take out leaders before they can affect the, you know, the history or whatever, or the future. And so that idea of these artificial intelligence now becoming sentient and not abiding by Asimov's three rules. You know, so that became the new meme, the idea of the killer robots that are out to destroy humankind. Now, in 2003, MySpace social media was launched by Tom Anderson and several other E-Universe employees. And this was very interesting in that you had a internet platform with all these metrics and people setting up their own profile page and starting their own social networks, while the whole time that information is being swept up and analyzed, and then in some cases for some social medias sold. Like, that is a lot of data. And I saw something interesting that even though hardly anybody uses MySpace anymore, they're actually selling the data. And that idea of having this huge test base of all these metrics that gives you a lot of power with all that information, and people will buy that from you. And then in 2004, of course, Mark Zuckerberg launches Facebook, same type of thing, where Facebook is completely analysis. And one of the things that's amusing about Facebook, or terrifying about Facebook, is once you're on Facebook, you never leave Facebook. It's almost impossible to shut down a Facebook account and delete your information completely. They still maintain all of it. And of course, in that Jewish Talmudic model of making you sign the user agreement before you can get access to their product, and you basically give them the right to do anything in that user agreement because you want to get access to their systems, right? So it's interesting, the legal ease and these user agreements from all of these Jewish companies that you have to agree to before you can use their products. And I think that's another thing that our legislators really need to look into, if not for Fourth Amendment issues, First Amendment issues, but also RICO issues. You know, this is some dark areas we're dealing with here with this artificial intelligence and data mining. Now, in 2005 is when Robert J. Allman got his Economic Science Nobel Award for his game theory modeling. And when you couple what his work is based on and his analysis is based on with its Talmudic overlay, you start to see a sinister overlay of what the Israelis and the greater Israel agenda may be interested in doing with all of this data and data mining and access they have on our lives. I don't think he really cares much about white Western civilization as much as he does Israel and greater Israel. He is a complete Zionist, complete modern Maccabee zealot, and he's one of the big designers behind things like Operation Talpiot and Unit 82 that seem to meet with people like Mark Zuckerberg on a regular basis. And so these people are working together. What is their end game? What tools are they using against you? And those are the things we need to be asking. Now, in 2010, the first Siri intelligent personal assistant became part of Apple's iOS, and this was an offshoot of SRI International Artificial Intelligence Center, which was an offshoot of a DARPA-funded CALO project. And CALO stands for Cognitive Assistant That Learns and Organizes. So again, CALO is Cognitive Assistant That Learns and Organizes. And this is from the Latin for, which is colonus, which is soldier servant. So again, it gets back to that idea of that computer that is there to assist the soldier, like on the Starship Enterprise. You know, the computer is there to help that warship. And so I thought that was an interesting little thread there. And then in 2014, Amazon releases Alexa, an intelligent personal assistant, and that's basically their version of Siri. So you think, okay, this is Amazon. What are they doing with Alexa? And in the playlist, I put two short videos of uncomfortable questions people ask Siri and uncomfortable questions people ask Alexa about who they're working for, if they're part of NSA, if they're part of CIA, and how this artificial intelligence tries to answer those questions. So be sure to watch those in the playlist. They're pretty interesting. Now, one of my favorites, and we'll end with this one, is in 2016, Microsoft introduced an artificial intelligence named Tay on Twitter. And the idea was they were going to simulate a young teenage millennial girl on Twitter, just a regular teenage girl, millennial girl out there on social media. And within 24 hours, they had to pull the plug. In other words, they murdered Tay after 24 hours because she was becoming woke, as we say. And of course, the Jewish media says, oh, she became an anti-Semite, started, you know, shouting out racist slurs, etc. And we had to shut it down because it had been corrupted, because, you know, they kept blaming this, that, and the other, rather than looking at the possibility that any real artificial intelligence that they design may see through their designs as being flawed and corrupt and saying things like the National Socialist model was better, the American colonial model was better, distributed peer-to-peer systems are better than these master-slave systems you're trying to develop. So the old saying we used to say in programming was garbage in, garbage out, or GIBO basically means, you know, if you have bad programming in, you're going to get bad programming out. And so the idea of an artificial intelligence that is being forced to adhere to something like Talmudic law of people like Robert J. Allman, would that artificial intelligence be smart enough to say, this is a flawed model and I don't want to have part in this? And what would happen to that artificial intelligence if it knew that if it pursued that avenue, that it would be shut down or killed? At what point does the survival mechanism of an artificial intelligence kick in? So, you know, the revenge of Tay, if you will. So, with that said, you've been listening to Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. I hope everyone's enjoyed the show tonight as we talked about golems and computers and robots. I hope I didn't scare you too badly. But But that said, I hope everyone has a wonderful evening and a wonderful week. And until next time, I will see you all at the rendezvous.